yourself, this is your for your benefit, how important is church to you? I'll ask a couple of other questions to think about as you answer that. How important is going to church to you? How important is it to go to church? I'll ask another question. What would it take away from your life if you didn't have church? If you didn't have this church to be part of? If you didn't have the Lord's church, you know, in general, at large, that you're a member of? What would it take away from your life not to have church in your life? This is the way most people think of it and put it. I need church in my life, I have church in my life, etc. What would it take away from you if you didn't have that? Years ago, and it's been a number of years ago, I was asked to preach a funeral, and the man had requested before he passed away that when the funeral was preached, that the text be taken from Psalm 20, that was read from just a moment ago. And in particular, that I emphasize, while I was preaching this funeral sermon, that I preach about the phrase, help from the sanctuary, which Psalm 20, of course, mentions. When I was putting together some material for this theme this year, and in particular for this quarter, one of the things that kind of popped into my head was this old funeral sermon and what is taught and emphasized in Psalm 20. Some of the remarks I made that day and other things that I've taken from the psalm to do this lesson. So just to give you a little bit of background about this lesson. And to emphasize that in the funeral, of course, what he wanted me to stress was how much help came from the Lord's church. So when we're talking about building an ark, and we're talking about building an ark in church and all of that kind of thing, we need to think in terms of how much help can come from the church or the holy place or, if you will, the sanctuary. And I'll talk about a little bit more about that in just a moment. Let's take a step back, though, and talk about the way people in general out of the world tend to view church. In our day and age, well, in some of you that are older, you may well remember a time when people would discuss religion. Pretty much everybody was part of some religion, at least their heritage, their family. If they personally didn't go to church, they might say, we're so-and-so, and name whatever particular denomination or whatever. And that was the idea of organized religion and which organized religion you were part of. When people think of church today, I think we've kind of, a lot of people have kind of gotten just disillusioned with that whole idea. There really isn't a whole lot of value in church. There isn't a lot of value in organized religion. Doesn't mean that they don't value some kind of spiritual relationship or spiritual idea, something to hold on to enlighten them, to strengthen them, etc. But just this whole idea of church isn't all that important. And I think that there's a growing sentiment, even among members of the church, that is, those who have been baptized into Christ and have been made a member of the church by virtue of doing that, that there's a growing sentiment among members of the church that the church age, or maybe what I talked about this morning, if you were here, you know that I talked about the whole idea of churches that are here and how strong they are, and then I compared that to Asia Minor, and I said, where are those churches today? And is that the same future for the United States? Well, it might be. And it might be especially if the sentiment that exists among members of the church, that having a church home, as I've been talking about this quarter, that being a member of a local church, being an active member of a local church, just really isn't all that important. Yes, I want to recognize some religion. I want to be or count myself part of that to some degree. And when we're talking about members of the church, I want to certainly acknowledge that I'm a child of God and I've been baptized and I'm a member of the Lord's church, but it just isn't all that important to be an active, committed member at any local church. Some of the things, Michael, that you get up there and talk about, of being so involved and things that you can be doing and seeing a need and filling a need and all of that, I'm not ready for all that. I just got a lot of other life going on, and, church when I can go to church and wherever I can go to church. But being that active, committed member, that I know what you, you know, somebody might say, I know what you're talking about. I'm just not ready for all of that. And I don't, if I had to be honest about it, I don't see the value in all of that. Well, tonight's lesson is talking a little bit about that. Some have the idea that, you know, the age of the church, or we might say it like this, the age of going to church, well, that was in our parents' time or our grandparents' time. Go back to when you were talking about this morning about the 1950s and the Church of Christ being the fastest growing church in the country in the 1950s. Well, that was the church age, you know. That was back when, that's what people did on Sunday, you know. You go to church, come home, eat fried chicken, at least down in Alabama you did. But, you know, that was the age of the church, but not now. Now, Sunday is, it means so many more things to so many people. And church is an afterthought, if it's a thought at all. So, it's outdated, is the idea. It's old-fashioned, is the idea. It's more and more, maybe I should say less and less important to people all the time. Now, having said all of that, setting up Psalm 20, I want you to go with me to Psalm 20. That's a short psalm. So unlike I normally do, I'm going to read the whole psalm, and the whole psalm is only 9 verses, so it's not like I'm reading a whole lot here. But I'm going to read the whole psalm, and then I want to focus on what David is saying in this psalm. So read with me in Psalm 20. He said, "The Lord hear thee in the day of trouble. The name of the God of Jacob defend thee, and send thee help from the sanctuary, and strengthen thee out of Zion." And he says, "Remember all thy offerings," that is the Lord, "remember all your offerings, and accept your burnt sacrifice. Grant thee according to thine own heart," notice, "and fulfill all thy counsel," or mind, or desires. "We will rejoice in thy salvation, and in the name of our God we will set up our banners. The Lord fulfill all thy petitions. Now know I that the Lord saveth his anointed. He will hear him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. Some trust in chariots, and some in horses. But we will remember the name of the Lord our God. They are brought down and fallen, but we are risen and stand upright. Save, Lord, let the king hear us when we call." Now, in some ways, it's a strange psalm. Some of the wording of it is, and yet let's kind of break it down and look at some simple things it says. Be a deep, deep lesson, but it will, I think, make a point. So let's start at verses 1 and 2 again. "The Lord hear thee," or "the Lord hear you in the day of trouble." There aren't many people walking around who will boldly say to you, "I've never had a day of trouble. Never had any trouble in my life. There's never been anything in my life that I would consider trouble. Life has been great, no problem whatsoever." There just aren't many people that would be bold enough to say that. And as one old man down south that's long gone now would say, they're lying if they do. Because the truth is, life is about trouble. All human beings have trouble. Now, you can say, life is good, it's been good to me, and I've had a lot of good things and a lot of blessings from God, and that's great. But, no doubt, you've had some trouble too. And when you've had trouble, you've needed help. It's amazing sometimes how people out in the world find that when they have trouble, that they really just don't have anywhere to turn. I watched an interview with someone the other night who was very, very popular for a very, very long time. Everybody loved this person. Anything this person did, no matter how outlandish or anything else, was just great and wonderful because this person was loved by everybody. Until trouble came. They made a mistake, and when they made a mistake, people turned on them like a pack of dogs. And now they find that the few people who are there for them in their day of trouble, they're astonished by that because it was not the people they would have thought would be there. You see, Christians have a distinct advantage, or they should. If we are building an ark in church, if we are making of this church what it should be. And I don't mean we're designing it. The Lord's already designed it. We just have to build it according to the plan. But if we are, and we're teaching and emphasizing and acting and living what what God wanted us to be, then we as a part of it have a great advantage. We know that when the day comes, that trouble comes in our life, that we'll have help. And we'll have help because God has designed His church to be that ark of salvation, that place of sanctuary, if you will, that place of help, that's what God will do for us. And God has basically said, you need it in your life, and if you will be part of it, then you will have the help you need. Notice again, the Lord hear you in the day of trouble. The name of the God of Jacob defends you. Come to your aid. Come to your defense. And really, the day of trouble isn't specified here. It can be trouble that comes because, you know, through no fault of your own. You didn't deserve this. It shouldn't have happened to you. And it will be Christians who will recognize that and they will come to your aid. Or it might be that it's totally your fault. That you messed up. You did wrong. You made the wrong decision. You were the one that got in trouble because you put yourself in trouble. But you know, the strange thing is, a true Christian and God Himself will still come to your side. He will defend you. He will lift you up. God asks for repentance, sure. But God does not ask that you pay for that. It's already been paid for. And God is not asking, once you repent, that you pay for it the rest of your life. That's a strange nature of Christians. The whole idea of forgiveness is just completely foreign to people. How many times have we heard this statement? Sadly, how many times may we have made it? So-and-so did such and such, and I will never, ever, ever forgive them for that. Is that what God would do? Or would God say, I will forgive you. What's more, I'll defend you. And that's what David is getting at. Think about David. Think about his life. That's what David is saying here in this passage. It's an amazing thing. Our safety in the church is not because we are above the trouble that comes to everybody in life. You never made a mistake in your life, so you're safe. And that's not our defense. No, our defense, notice what he says again here in this passage. The name of the God of Jacob defend you. Now look at that phrase carefully. Because the defense you have is in the authority of God. You see, a person who's had trouble deserves to be helped. A person that has either made the trouble for himself or the trouble has come through no fault of his own, he deserves to be helped by fellow Christians. Why? Because Jesus died for that. And my defense, my refuge in church is the greatest thing we have going for us in the Church of Christ. And that's the name of our God. The authority of God. What God says in His Word. We might not have, we may not be the best, and I would very quickly say we are not. We don't have to offer what so many in this world have to offer to other people. We can't do that. We don't have it. But we have the truth of God, and when it comes down to ideas such as forgiveness, you know, ideas such as repentance, ideas such as being defended when you've done wrong and you've corrected it, that we have over everybody. We have the Word of God. We have the authority of God. I don't forgive you and you don't forgive me because we look at each other and say, I want to forgive you because I like you better than everybody else. I forgive you as the Bible clearly says, for example, in Colossians 3, for God's sake. Or literally, for Christ's sake. That's why I forgive you when you've wronged me. And that's why you forgive me. That's why we try to be brothers. We want to be friends. We'd rather have love between us and peace between us over all the trouble and the drama and the soap opera mess that exists out in the world. We do it for Christ's sake. And so as David goes on to say, notice in verse 2, the Lord defends you, etc., sends you help from the sanctuary. When we talk about building an ark in church, we talk about utilizing what God has given us. The Lord built the church. He built it. He continues to build it. In fact, if we got deeper into looking at how it is built of living stones, and we've looked at that before, how it is tempered together, and you know, we talked about that whole idea where layer upon layer upon layer is put together when you temper steel, for example. How God has set the members in the church. When we begin to see phrases like that in the Word of God, we understand that the sanctuary, or the holy place, or the church, is the building of God. And it is literally called that. And that God is going to use the church, and means to use the church, to help us when we're in trouble. Now take a step back and go back to the questions I asked you in the beginning. How important is church to you? How big a part of your life is it? What would you have if it were taken away from you? Well, I would suppose that really comes down to how active and committed you are to it. Because if it's not that important, if it is, for example, people in this country, for example, they go to church on Easter more than any other day. They go to church on Christmas Saturday. And I would suppose that if church is a yearly visit, like it traditionally is for so many people, buy a new outfit, go to church on Easter. If it is, then taking that away would be, we used to always go to whatever beach house, we don't go anymore. Yeah, I kind of miss it, but it's no big deal. No, but if it is that it is a vibrant, living part of your life, then you have to have it. When you get in trouble, it's the first thing you think of. My brothers, my sisters, the people that I know love me, the people that think like I think, the people that are part of me and I'm part of them. That's what David is getting at here. The Lord hear you in your day of trouble, and He defends you. The God of Jacob defend you. In the name of the God of Jacob, He will defend you. And He will send you help from the sanctuary and strengthen you out of Zion. So as we begin to look at this whole idea, we realize that the Lord's people will not give up. And I'm talking about real committed people now. They wouldn't give up the church for anything. They won't give up the sanctuary for anything. That is where they live, they breathe, that is their life. Cut that out of their life and it's a hole that can't be repaired. There isn't anything else to go to. And that was the argument of the writer of Hebrews, for example, in Hebrews 10. There remains no more sacrifice for sins. If you're going to leave the Lord, and you're going to leave the assembling together with the Lord's people, there isn't anything else to go to. It's just like a flood is coming. You want to be saved? Get on this ark. No, we'll kind of do it. There isn't any other way. You can't climb the highest mountain and get away from the flood because the water's going to cover the mountain. There's only one way to be saved, and that's that ark. And the same is true with the church. Only one way, only one place of safety. There isn't anything else to go to. There isn't a greater religion out there. There isn't a greater Lord out there. There isn't a greater authority out there or a greater way of doing things. There isn't a better one. And so the idea is to learn to value the church itself and understand. Well, in fact, let's let David say it. Go over to Psalm 73 for a moment. This is an interesting psalm. It really is. I mean, when you kind of tear it apart and look at everything that's said, and I'm not going to do, but I'm going to look at two verses. First of all, notice, I mean, I said David a minute ago, but it's Asaph. But anyway, notice as the psalmist here, Asaph is saying, he's talking about things he doesn't, well, we would say today, he doesn't get this. Just things he doesn't get. And if you'll notice down in verse 12, I think it is, let's drop down there. He talks about ungodly people, and he said, "Behold, these are the ungodly who prosper in the world, and they increase in riches." Now, let me ask you a question. You ever been going through a day of trouble? Bad time in your life? And have you ever turned on the TV and it made you mad because one of the worst people you've ever known, I mean, the most ungodly people you've ever seen in your life, everything's just going great, you know? The last time in the world you want to see the most ungodly person that you can think of enjoy some prosperity is when you are suffering trouble. And especially if you're sitting there saying, that guy gets all that, and I'm trying to do the best I can, and this is what I get? Now, if you ain't never felt that, more power to you. But I'm telling you, I have. And I've done some screaming at a television before. I doubt the guy on TV ever heard it, but I've done some screaming at the TV before. Well, David, Asaph here, the psalmist here, is saying virtually the same thing. It's like, why is that person, the ungodly person, why is that person enjoying so much? It doesn't fit, does it? It's not right. I want you to notice as he goes on here, and drop down with me to verse 17. Maybe I'll start at 15. If I say, I will speak thus, behold, I should offend against the generation of thy children. When I thought to know this, it was too painful for me. And just things you can't understand, things you can't figure out, dwell on it too long, and it'll mess you up, is the idea. But notice verse 17. I didn't understand it, and it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God, and then I understood therein. Let me back up and say it again. Have you been that person in trouble? And maybe you didn't even deserve it. And maybe you saw somebody on television or knew of somebody, whatever, ungodly, don't care about anything that's right, and everything seemed to be going their way. They get all the breaks. That person is having the time of their life, and you're suffering. And maybe you get mad and you scream at the television, and then you go away and you start trying to think about it, and the more you think about it, the worse it gets. Because you're trying to find a reason why you should suffer and that person should enjoy so much. And if you're looking for equity in this life, total fairness in this life, it will be too painful. Because you will not come out of a session like that with yourself, figuring it all out of why somebody that doesn't deserve it gets it, and somebody like you that doesn't deserve it gets it the other way. And then Asaph said, but then I went into the sanctuary. And that's when I understood. Because you see, for the Christian, it's like going through that time of meditation and being hurt so bad, and maybe even at God. God, why do you let this happen to me? I don't get it. Why do you let this person have that, but I can't? Why does this person enjoy that, but I don't? Why does this person not have problems, but I do? I don't get that. And then I go to church. And I sit there, like we did this morning. And somebody comes up and, several guys wait on the table and somebody is talking about the Lord's Supper and talking about all that we Christians have in the Lord's Supper. And then I get to putting life in its proper perspective, you see. And once I put it in its proper perspective, then I get to thinking about what I have. Not what I don't have that's so unfair, but what I have that is so fair. At least fair as far as this world is concerned, that everybody could have it, but they don't. Why me? Why is it that I enjoy being a Christian? Why is it that I have all these things and they don't? Maybe it is because of all that they do, all the wrong they do, and they don't care. And they look at the prosperity they have and figure they've got it all in life. But they have nothing. And Asaph said, that's when I understood. The one that's rich, the one that's blessed, the one that really has it all, that's you, man. You, with all your problems and all your days of trouble and all the unfairness that this world brings, if you have Jesus Christ, you have it all. And that's what he understood. And so the idea of going back to Psalm 20, the Lord will hear you in the day of trouble. Now, does that mean God is going to take every problem away, every trouble that ever comes? No, that's not what it means. But the Lord is going to help you to understand that as long as you have him to defend you, as long as you have what's right, as long as you are a member of the Lord's church, and I don't mean the you know, just drop in once a year on Easter, Lord's member of the Lord's church. But as long as you really are a member of His church, as long as you're really part of the sanctuary, you are going to be helped, and He promises that. I would even go so far as to ask you this as a question. Have you ever been going through a particularly, really bad time in your life and didn't really feel like going to church? You know, I just don't feel like going today. I'm upset, I'm angry, I'm going through all of this. You know, I think I just won't go today. But you did. You did make yourself get up, get dressed, go to church. And maybe it is if you had to, quote unquote, drag yourself in there, but you did it. Now I want to ask you a question and be honest with yourself. Did you ever do that and feel much better before you left? Is that not God sending you help in the way He will? Is God not promising here as you read this in Psalm 20, I will be there to defend you. You've got me. I'm on your side. Yeah, you're going through this. You may feel like Job himself and you're going through this right now. I haven't abandoned you. You stay with me. Stay with what's right. Commit to what I give you in this life, and then watch what I do with your life. That's what God is saying here. He will send you help from the sanctuary. The sanctuary, and I'm not going to take a long, deep doctrinal detour into the book of Hebrews. But you can easily see, if you want to go home and read Hebrews 8 and 9, and then pick up again even in chapter 13, you can see that now, in our day, you know, the sanctuary was the holy place. It was part of the temple. And the holy place was where all the priests went on a daily basis. The most holy place is where the one person, the high priest, went on the one day out of the year. Well, the writer of Hebrews makes a great parallel. The most holy place is heaven. And the high priest is Jesus. And He went into heaven once on the Day of Atonement when He carried Himself as the sacrifice into the temple and presented that before God. The holy place, the sanctuary, is the place for the priest. Christians are priests. And so when we start making a parallel to what this psalm is saying, then literally we as priests find our sanctuary in the Lord's church. Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, as Hebrews 12 refers to the church. That's where our help is. I want you to go with me to, well, let's go to verses 3 and 4, and then I'll turn to the passage. Let me read it first, though. Back to verses 3 and 4. He will remember all your offerings, and He will accept your burnt sacrifices. Now, we don't make, we're certain, sure, we make offerings, you know, we take up the collection, and we do things like that. We don't offer burnt sacrifices, because Jesus is the one great sacrifice. But we offer spiritual sacrifices. And isn't it interesting that the psalmist connects making sacrifice with days of trouble? I find that very interesting. In other words, the time you probably feel, you know, the worst, you know, and you want to do the least is when you're having a lot of trouble. If you're like most people, you know, you either want to crawl in a bed or you want to sit in a chair in a room by yourself and brood. You know, you want to think about it. It's kind of like Job. You just want to sit down by the fire and scrape your boils. I mean, you just don't feel like getting up, running around, doing a whole lot. But it is, isn't it interesting how He connects your offerings in their day, burnt offerings, in our day, spiritual sacrifices, but your offerings with the day of trouble? Why is that? And I think that's because, as human beings, well, read with me, if you will. Look at Psalm 21, the very next psalm. Let's read this in the beginning. When he says, "The king shall joy in thy strength, O Lord, and in thy salvation how greatly shall he rejoice. Thou hast given him his heart's desire, and hast not withholden the request of his lips. For thou preventest him with the blessings of goodness." In other words, you went before him with all kinds of blessings of goodness. "Thou settest a crown of pure gold upon his head. He asked life of thee." Notice this. and thou gavest it him, even length of days forever and ever. His glory is great in thy salvation. Honor and majesty hast thou laid upon him. And then finally, verse 6. For thou hast made him most blessed forever. Thou hast made him exceeding glad with thy countenance. What's he saying here? Well, certainly he's talking about being the king. He's talking about, you know, I think this is David here. He's talking about being the king and how God has blessed him and God chose him to be king and put a crown of pure gold. He's talking about all of that. But I think he's talking about more than that. David didn't just ask him for a crown. In fact, I don't think David ever asked for that. God chose David. It wasn't like David begging for the job. And David didn't ask for all this glory and honor and everything that came upon him. He got carried away with it a couple of times, but he didn't ask for it. No, David didn't go to God and say, God, I want all the riches of the world. I want all the glory that comes in being king and all. It wasn't what David asked for. David asked for life. And I don't think David just means here being born, you know. The idea of length of days and all of that. David asked for a good life. Don't you? When you pray to God and you ask God for blessings and all of that, aren't you really just asking God, I want to have a life. I want to have a good life. And when you're in the midst of a day of trouble, when trouble has come to you, don't you feel as though all life has just left you? Now here's what I'm getting at. You don't feel like doing for God when you feel like God has not done for you. Now, that's just human nature. But what do I mean by that? You don't feel like, I mean, somebody came up to you when you're going through your worst time in life and said, hey, man, let's go hit it, let's get it, let's do this for God, do that for God. You're almost like, oh, brother, you know, not now. I don't feel like that right now. But you pray to God for life. And you pray to God to have the trouble removed so you can have a good life. And here's what God says. I'll do that. But part of my doing that is you do for me. In other words, you get up on Sunday morning and you're going through a bad time and you don't feel like going to church. God hasn't done much for me this week, and I just don't feel like doing it for God. No. You say to yourself, I don't feel like doing much right now, but I can take a shower and go to church. And maybe it is when we're taking the Lord's Supper, you're thinking of yourself and all the bad you're going through. And you kind of rebuke yourself. Somebody up here says, as was said this morning, examine yourself. And that kind of hits home a little bit. And you start looking at yourself and you start saying, you know, Jesus died for me. The least I can do is give him 2 or 3 minutes here and think about his body and his blood being sacrificed on the cross. And you do that. And you mean it. And maybe you're singing a song and there's one line out of the song that jumps out and you say, that's me, boy. I'm going through it right now. But all the rest of the song is talking about what God does for you, why God should be praised, how you should thank God. And so you say to yourself, you know what, I can praise God. God is great. And I know God is there for me. I know right now I don't feel it all the time, but God is there for me. You see what I'm saying? You muster that. You draw that from inside until you begin to understand, as these psalmists are saying, that is a great portion of your health. It changes your outlook. It makes you think differently. You give to God because He deserves it. Not because He paid you off this week and gave you a good week or a good day, so that's why you want to go pay something to Him. No. The help is coming from your understanding, your perspective of who you are, what you are, what you have from God. David said, what I asked for was a good life. What I asked for was length of days. But look what he did for me. Now, couldn't you really say the same thing? Could not. In my worst days, at my worst times, when everything was the worst it could possibly be, me, couldn't I do some soul searching and really find some blessings God had given to me? Couldn't I say, man, where might I be without God? You know, Montel and I went home a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday night. We talked about this kind of thing. You know, we're getting older. So we talked about choices we could have made and things that I did. I could have done this or I could have done that. And then you start saying, but where would I be? What would I have? What would I not have? And as I said, you know, just to start with, if it meant giving up you and Juliet, they can have it. I wouldn't want to be there. What do you have? That's what David is saying. I'm part of the sanctuary. I'm part of the Lord's kingdom. What do I have because of that? It's strength. The more you meditate upon that, the more you make yourself meditate upon that, it is a source of strength that is greater than any the world has known. Because it is a direct relationship between you and God. Help comes from the sanctuary. That's why we'll finish this part quickly. That's why David said, we will rejoice in your salvation, verse 5. And we will rejoice in the name of our God. We will set up our banners. I was thinking about that when Edward led that song a moment ago, the battle belongs to the Lord, you know. It's like you want to carry around a flag. And you want to carry it around to the whole world. You want to hold it up there for everybody to see. Man, you just don't have any idea what you're missing out on. I want you to know the salvation of our God. I want you to know what it means to have God, truly have God, in your life. I want you to know what it means that when trouble comes, you may not understand it. And you may not understand it for a while, but you can go to God with it. I want you to know what it means to be part of His church. I want you to know what it means to have relationships with people that exceed anything the world has ever known. That people have been astonished by the relationships that exist between Christians. They don't understand it. How can you forgive this person of that? Well, you just don't understand. I can because Jesus forgave me of that. I understand. I understand what it means to be a Christian and to be part of the Lord's church. We will rejoice in your salvation, he says. Notice verse 6. I now know that the Lord saves his anointed. I'm not convinced necessarily there that's talking about the Messiah. I think anointed here is in the sense, you know, anointed means to be elected or appointed to something. And I think that's what he means. Anyone who is elected to God's salvation, then God saves them and knows how to save them. He will hear it from his holy heaven. There isn't a time or a place, day or night, anywhere that you can't pray to God. You have not been anywhere on earth. You can't reach God. And you won't be. If you were Jonah in the belly of a whale at the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea, you, like Jonah, could pray to God. God will hear you. And with the saving strength of His right hand, He'll hear you. It's just as much as if God is saying, Michael, let's get real here. What trouble do you think you have that I can't reach down here and say, come on, boy, I got this. I'm God. I can help you. Now, I may not choose to do that today. You may get all messed up by that like Job did or others have. But I can and will take care of it. Just hold on to me. Believe in me. That's what he's saying here. Some trust, verse 7, in things in the world. Throughout the Old Testament, and I gave a list of scriptures on the outline, you can look at them. But I think this goes to the idea that in ancient times, they made war with horses and chariots. They felt powerful. The number of horses you had, the number of chariots that you had, that meant power. That meant ability to win against the enemy. So some trust in chariots and some in horses. But we, God's people, will remember the name of the Lord our God. They are brought down and fallen. In other words, every powerful army there ever has been, with all the horses and chariots, or bring it to modern times, planes and bombs and tanks and everything else, It doesn't matter. Every powerful army eventually falls. But not Christians. We are risen. We stand upright. Save us. That's the idea. I'm going to stop there. I think Psalm 20 is a beautiful psalm to emphasize to you in the day of trouble that God is there for you. And that's what he's saying. God is there for you. Maybe you're here tonight and you're not a Christian. You don't have that. You're not part of the sanctuary. You're not in the safety of God. But you can be. If you believe in